This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none who get left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
Now, I am not guilty.
I have a rather disturbing one for you today. I mean, they are all disturbing and terrible and awful, but this one will just kind of put an extra bummer on your day, so enjoy. This is the murder of Erica Parsons. On the surface, the Parsons family of Rowan County, North Carolina, which is northeast of Charlotte, with a population of about 150,000, looked ordinary enough. They lived in a modest home on Miller Chapel Road, they attended church, and they homeschooled their children. So the family consisted of Mom Casey and Dad Sandy Parsons, as well as kind of a growing brood of children that some of them that they had adopted into their fold. Parents just kind of doing their best with limited means, and neighbors always saw children playing outside of their home. But like the walls of Facebook, which provide a bit of a facade into all this togetherness and happy, shining, smiling faces, inside the walls of the Parsons home lay some dark secrets that would not come to light until many years after the fact. At the center of these secrets was a young girl named Erica Parsons. Erica Lynn Parsons had been born February 24th, 1998 in Concord, North Carolina. Her biological parents were Carolyn Parsons and Billy Goodman, but both of them had been struggling financially and kind of emotionally at the time of her birth. Carolyn was raising three other children already, and she had separated then from her husband, Steve Parsons, when she became pregnant by Billy. And so the decision was made to put Erica up for adoption. And Carolyn would later kind of explain her decision, saying, quote, "I didn't want her to grow up in shelters like I did. I thought they could give her a better life," end quote. Now, Erica's biological father, Billy, died of natural causes in 2016. But although it was a private adoption, Carolyn was able to put Erica with family members, and those relatives were Sandy and Casey Parsons. So Carolyn believed, perhaps a little bit naively, that she was entrusting Erica to them, that would mean that they would have a stable home. Casey was Steve's sister-in-law, and so the arrangement kept Erica in the extended family orbit, as it were. And the adoption was finalized in the year 2000 when Erica was about 2 years old. Carolyn still visited occasionally. She kept a sort of a tenuous connection to her daughter until around January of 2011. She loved Erica very deeply, but she truly believed that she had done the right thing for her. Now, looking back, of course, years later, Carolyn's regret was absolutely crushing. She said, quote, "She was my baby. I gave her up because I thought she'd have a better life. I was wrong," end quote. Now, Erica was born with a slight hearing impairment, but otherwise was a healthy baby with bright eyes and the rather shy smile. Now, in photographs from her early years, she's small, but she's cheerful. She's often holding toys or kind of clinging to the adults that are around her. On July 30th, 2013, a teenage Jamie Parsons, who was Erica's brother, walked into a Rowan County police station to report that Erica was missing. The last time that he had laid eyes on her was November of 2011, like 2 years before that. So Jamie had grown up in the same house as Erica, and although he had been told by Sandy and Casey that she had gone to stay with their nan, a woman named Irene Goodman, from her biological dad's side, he still feared the worst. That Sandy and Casey had killed Erica and then had made up this story to cover their tracks. Now, of course, there was something that the police had first took as sort of a fanciful tale, that this teenage boy who was maybe fed up with his parents' rules and looking for a little bit of revenge of some kind, not really understanding the ramifications of making such a horrific accusation against somebody. But Jamie's story had details to it, like how on that last day he saw his sister, which was around the 19th of November in 2011, in his words, quote, "She didn't look too good. She looked like a zombie. She said she did not feel good. She said that she could not breathe too good," end quote. So Jamie had commented to Casey about that she didn't look to be in a very good way, and that Casey had told him to shut the fuck up. And the next morning, there was no sign of Erica. And he remembered that day that Sandy had looked very pale that day, like he might throw up. Now, Casey, on the other hand, she acted like nothing had happened at all. And when Jamie asked, like, where Erica was, she had simply stated that she had gone to live with her grandmother in Asheville. Jamie also had some details to share of life inside the Parsons home, which on the outside appeared to be a home filled with children and laughter and love, with this dedicated mom who was homeschooling her children. But according to Jamie, there were daily cruelties, mostly directed at Erica, like hours of being forced to stand in the corner. There were beatings with belts and wooden objects. She was locked in closets and denied access to food. And he even said that at times Erica had been forced to eat dog food and even dog feces as punishment for some of the most mundane and small of infractions. Now, all of the children were abused to various degrees, according to Jamie, but Erica had gotten the worst of it. It was daily for her, and she was kind of like an outlet for everybody in the family's cruelty. As unbelievable as Jamie's story was, they made their way to Sandy and Casey's house to speak with them. And of course, both Sandy and Casey vehemently denied all of Jamie's accusations and said that he had said what he did because of some of Jamie's recent rebellious behaviors, that he had been asked to leave the house, and so that he was angry at them, and this was his way of getting back at them, which was something the police initially suspected, that he was making up lies to try to get them in trouble, that Erica had simply gone off to live with her nan Irene, and that there was really, that was all there was to the story. There was just nothing to see here.
Breaking here at 6, Salisbury police are looking for a missing 15-year-old girl who was last seen in 2011. But Erica Lynn Parsons was just reported missing by a stepbrother or sister on July 30th. That was just 6 days ago. We don't know why she wasn't reported missing sooner. We're going to stay on top of this story, bring you new details as they develop.
Erica Parsons is 4 feet 5 inches tall. She weighs 85 to 90 pounds and has brown eyes and brown hair. If you have any information about where she is, call the Rowan Sheriff's Office, the number on your screen, 704-216-8700.
In fact, Sandy and Casey actually took to the media to deny the accusations against them and try to clear some things up for people, including a rather notorious interview on the show Dr. Phil. Now, in this interview, this whole interview was very interesting. I can't play it for you because it's copywritten, but let's just say that Casey doesn't really do much to make herself look like she's not guilty of something. At best, child abuse, and at worst, murder, starting with saying that in her belief, they were model parents. And anyone with kids knows none of us feel that way. I might think I was a pretty good mom overall, but I certainly made some mistakes and the self-doubt of parenthood is a real thing. Now, on the show, Casey claimed that Irene Goodman had reached out to her by email, claiming to be related to Erica on Billy's side. So this would have been around maybe August or September of 2011. And they had some back and forth conversations. And Casey really wanted Erica to have a connection to her dad's side of the family. And Erica and Nan had sort of started to form this bond just talking to each other over the phone. And so the decision was made that she would go and, well, initially the decision was that she would go visit her. And then later the decision was that she would live with her. And that Erica in the she was not missing at all, despite the fact that she herself, like Casey, had not heard from her in about a year and a half. But she trusted that she was fine. Now, she had come home for Thanksgiving in 2011, but she wanted to go back and live with this Nan, but she didn't pack anything, like at all. And she said about that, well, Grandma said that she would get her whatever she needed. So she would have been about 15 at this time, just to kind of give you some perspective here. So then Casey says that in February of 2012, she called Nan and she could hear Erica in the background of the phone, and that Erica was saying things like, please don't send me back to that bitch, etc., which Casey was sad to hear, but you know, teenagers, I guess they say stuff like that. So she then let her stay with this Nan, and then suddenly the phone number that she used to call was disconnected, and she figured, well, that's fine. I guess I'll just reconnect with her when she's an adult. Like, no big deal. So Sandy, all the while Casey is saying all this stuff, is just sticking to, like, my wife is a great mom, and I felt that if she was okay with all of this, then I trusted her and I supported her decisions. Like, basically, I had nothing to do with nothing. I didn't know nothing. I just let her do whatever she wanted to do. Now, I did find some snippets of interviews that Casey and Sandy did with this Salisbury Post that I could probably play some of the audio of, so you can get kind of a sense of their demeanor and their voice tone during all of these conversations regarding their missing daughter.
She was normal, just like my other daughter, just a happy-go-lucky little girl, loved boys. When she was even in public school, it was her biggest problem was boys. She would go after them. she wanted another round of piercings in her ears. We already did one. We weren't going to let her do a second. She didn't. Her last day wasn't in November.
Or roughly around that time.
She,
when was the last
day? The third trip that she went to Nan's on, and that's the final trip and where she stayed with Nan, was December 17th of 2011.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
And that was supposed to be a three-week trip for Christmas. She had already went and visited in November and come back for, like, it was a Thanksgiving, but it wasn't on the Thanksgiving week because she was with us that week. But she went for that weekend in November and come back. She also went in another weekend in September and come back. I've been talking to Nan since July of 2011, and the first time I met her face-to-face was in September of 2011.
Nan.
No, all three times we met at the Mooresville McDonald's, okay. All three times.
Was there a particular reason why you all wanted to meet at the McDonald's?
She had a four-hour drive, and that's actually the spot that she said that she knew and asked us, was we willing to meet there? And that's, we've always met there.
What do you think he was hoping to accomplish by going to law enforcement?
He wanted me to go to jail. I put him in jail every time he's been in jail. I'm the one that did it. And he's always, every time he would get mad over anything, he always brought that up to me. You put me in jail, you ruined my life. Nobody will give me a job because you made me have a record. And It was always my fault. Homicide investigations wanted to know, did we sell her? He asked us that. It told her that I had a lot of medical bills and said that they know probably got hard. So what did we do? Sell her to people. And we did not do nothing like that. And it was just all these different accusations that it was just getting too hard. We gave her away, or it was just too much stress on everything. Did we just do away with her? And it was very horrible stuff that they would say.
On the Dr. Phil show, they both took polygraph tests that came back as deceptive, but you can take that with what you will. It's a polygraph and it's Dr. Phil, so I don't know. Now, in the background, investigators are trying to either verify or debunk Sandy and Casey's account, and they discover a few things by interviewing some family members and just doing their normal detective poke around bits that they do. Casey has a sister named Robin Time, and Robin went so far as to testify that she had told her, like Casey had told her, she couldn't stand the sight of Erica's face. But Casey then would always take her back in because in Robin's opinion, they would be able to collect then the money from the government for having her in their custody. Now, Jamie confirmed that Erica was singled out for the brunt of the abuse that was suffered in the home. Brooke, who's Casey's biological daughter, would often get like regular affection from her mom, where Erica, on the other hand, was given these punishments and often confined to her room and denied food, and that she was exclusively homeschooled, so outsiders never set eyes on her so that they could see that there were bruises and that there was malnourishment happening, that she was getting frail. And Casey's own mother, Shirley, had also noticed some disturbing and troubling signs. And that started actually when Erica was just a little girl. Bruises and even once a black eye, which Casey, of course, quickly explained away for by saying that Erica, one of her older brothers, and Casey's own mother, Shirley, had also noticed some disturbing and troubling signs. And that started actually when Erica was just a little girl. Bruises and even once a black eye, which Casey, of course, quickly explained away for by saying that Erica, one of her older brothers or something, had hit her or she'd had an accident or whatever. And the police discover that there is no Irene Goodman. Billy's mom had actually died back in 2005, and her name was actually Chloe. There was no one named Irene in the entire Goodman family tree. Sheriff Kevin Auten said, quote, "It was a lie from the beginning. There was no Irene Goodman. They created a fictional person to cover up what they had done," end quote. Which is obvious foreshadowing on my part, putting that little quote in there, but let's continue. Also, according to Jamie, by 2010, when Erica entered her teen years, the abuse kind of hit a bit of a crescendo. Her growth was stunted by that point. She was severely malnourished and socially isolated completely. She was withdrawn. She was frail. She was sickly. However, after her disappearance in June 2011, Jamie suspected what actually happened. He also suspected that this Irene or Nan was just a fictional person, but he was trapped in this toxic environment and scared for his own safety. So he knew better to just drop the subject, keep his head down and move forward until he himself could escape, which came 2 years later. Sheriff Auten said about Jamie's help, quote, "Without Jamie, this case might never have come to light. He was the only one who finally broke the silence," end quote. But Casey and Sandy were sticking to their story. After providing the police with this fake address for Nan and a phone number, and when they were confronted with that, they kept to their story. And even when Billy Goodman, who was still alive in 2013, said that there was no Irene in their family whatsoever, they continued to stick to their story, that she had disappeared and Nan was probably hiding her, or she was hiding herself because she was a teenager and just didn't realize all the trouble that she was causing for her parents. Obviously, suspicion on the parents was mounting by the day, but the police had no indication that Erica was actually dead and not just missing. So after their little appearance on the Dr. Phil show, they found themselves, as did the police, under quite a bit of scrutiny and disbelief, as you can kind of imagine.
In the lion's den, we have a fantastic panel, including TV host Jill Simonian, a panel, and I'll start with Joe Gomez, a feisty reporter from KRLD in Dallas. What the heck?
And the pressure was kind of on the police to find Erica and prove that Casey and Sandy were lying and to hold them accountable. But again, there's no body. So they executed some search warrants at the house. They took all of their computers, their documents, anything that they could get their hands on pretty much in the house. And they were able to make a case for fraud, that they had continued to collect these government checks since November of 2011 when Erica was not in their home anymore. By 2014, federal investigators had built this rock-solid case against them for fraud. So Casey and Sandy were charged with multiple counts of mail fraud, wire fraud, and theft of government funds, and that they had, over several years, had collected about $14,000 in adoption assistance and benefits for Erica, which, of course, was long after she had disappeared. So at the trial, the government, who was doing the prosecution, they laid out this timeline that payments had continued. The bank records continued to show the deposits and that there was no proof after November of 2011 that Erica was alive. And then family testimony created this picture that Jamie Parsons and his aunt Robin Ashley testified that Casey routinely abused Erica. Robin said that she had admitted to hating the sight of Erica's face and had sent her away to prevent her from killing her on occasions before that. Jamie described these horrific punishments that Erica had received, that she had been locked in a closet, she had eaten dog food, she was beaten every day. And the jury in the fraud case was completely stunned. Like, this was not just fraud. This was a backdrop to a child's disappearance and probably murder. In 2015, both Casey and Sandy were convicted of the fraud charges, and Sandy received 8 years in prison and Casey received 10 years. At sentencing, the judge, Thomas Schroeder, condemned them, basically said, quote, "You took advantage of the system, you took advantage of a child, and you did it for money. That is as low as it gets," end quote. Now, though these convictions were for fraud, the unspoken reality of it was that kind of everybody knew that Erica was likely dead. So the fraud convictions meant that both Casey and Sandy were going to prison, but Erica's body still had not been found. And so for the investigators, this case remained unfinished for them. Now, there was a breakthrough then that came in 2016. Sandy was under quite a bit of pressure to say what he knew, and he didn't have much left to lose. So he finally confessed to his lawyer that Erica was in fact dead. And according to him, Erica had died in 2011 after one of Casey's beatings. And afraid of being caught, they had concealed her body and then created this Irene Goodman story to cover up their tracks. And Sandy was actually able to lead the investigators to this rural site off in Chesterfield County, which was in South Carolina, so about 45 miles south of their home in North Carolina. It was a remote little spot off of Blair Hendricks Roads, which was near where Sandy's parents had once lived, and there buried in this shallow grave were the skeletal remains of a small child. And the medical examiner was able to confirm what everybody kind of already suspected, that they were in fact Erica's remains. An autopsy was done that revealed multiple fractures, which was evidence of chronic abuse. There was evidence of chronic malnutrition and signs consistent with long-term abuse. Dr. Cynthia Gardner, who is the forensic pathologist, she said, quote, "This was a child who suffered for years. You can see it in her bones," end quote. So for Carolyn Parsons, her biological mom, the confirmation was devastating to her. Like, she had clung for a long time to this just little sliver of hope that her daughter might actually be alive somewhere. But knowing the truth, she spoke to reporters and said, quote, "I gave her up because I thought she'd be safe and they killed her. I'll never forgive them," end quote.
My name is Carolyn Parsons. I am Erica Lynn Parsons' biological mother. You have made no efforts to reach out to anybody to come forward with the truth. I have been upfront. I have been honest. I have gave names. I have gave locations, anything and everything I knew. There are more people that were failed and helped fail than just Casey. I still completely believe that Casey Stone Parsons has no heart. She has no soul. She is a body that is just there. She is an individual who just functions. The only thing Casey gets is what Erica doesn't. She gets to live. But in return for living, she will probably be in solitary confinement. And every time she gets out, she gets to listen to people talk about her, listen to people whisper about her. She gets to wonder, am I going to make it back to my cell tonight? Am I going to wake up in the morning? What is my life going to be like tomorrow? Oh, that's right. You don't have a life.
So once Erica's remains were recovered, the prosecutors were ready to go. So in February 2018, Casey and Sandy were indicted for murder. Not just murder, but also felony child abuse, felony concealment of a death, and obstruction of justice. In the indictment, it alleged that between 2005 and 2011, Casey and Sandy had maliciously punished, tortured, and abused Erica, which led to her death. So in 2019, both Casey and Sandy had to go to court in Rowan County to face murder charges. Of course, there was overwhelming evidence against Casey and testimony, of course, from her own family. So she entered what's called an Alford plea, where she could maintain her innocence, but acknowledged that basically the prosecution had enough evidence to convict her. She was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Sandy, on the other hand, who had, I guess, technically cooperated with investigators and was able to reveal the location of Erica's remains, he pled guilty to second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 30 to 40 years in prison. And at the sentencing, the judge in this case was Anna Wills Wagner. She said, quote, "This child never had a chance. She was starved, beaten, humiliated, and in the end, discarded. It is the most tragic case this court has ever seen," end quote.
They carry a different label. It's not for embezzling government money or stealing from a child. They now go in as a child murderer. That's something they have to figure out, not me. We are here in front of the Rowan County Courthouse today because Casey Stone Parsons pled guilty on all charges. I've said all along that Casey deserved life in prison versus the death sentence. I still 100% agree with that because their life in prison living, her life in prison living, will be worse than any death sentence she could ever get.
Having that conviction in the court case did bring a little bit of justice, but no comfort to Carolyn Parsons, who was Erica's biological mother. She has since become an advocate for children, for child welfare reform. She has spoken openly about the pain of giving her daughter up, believing that it was for the best, and then only to see her end up essentially in the hands of monsters. Quote, I will live with that guilt forever, but I'll also fight to make sure no other child goes through what Erica did, end quote. This case has also fueled some debates over oversight of homeschooling, adoption subsidies, and then just the lack of regular welfare checks that is on adopted children. Like, how could Erica have vanished for 2 years without anyone outside the house noticing that at all? Like, and how could federal benefits continue to go out and be cashed without any kind of verification that the child is still alive or still living where they say they are? Sheriff Otten reflected years later on this case, saying, quote, if you take anything away from this, it's that every missing child report needs to be taken seriously. Erica deserved better. She deserved to be found sooner, end quote. Erica's rather short life was defined by betrayal. She was betrayed by the adoptive parents who said that they were going to love her. She was betrayed by a system that never checked on her, and then betrayed essentially by a society that kind of just let her vanish without ever asking any questions about it. Carolyn has said again and again that she was my baby and I want the world to remember her. And that was the murder of Erica Parsons. And as you might know, if you've been a longtime listener, this would normally be my season finale of whatever season I'm in. I think it's 5. But I'm actually going to continue to kind of just do my thing. I'll take breaks as I need them. I need to make sure that I focus on the exclusive and Patreon members, that they're getting what they paid for, which is 2 podcast episodes a month, and that when the videos come out, that they come out a little bit early and that they're ad-free. And of course, episodes are ad-free when you're on the exclusive. I do have to remember that this is not my job and that I do this as a passion and not, you know, for a living. I have I guess it's 5 years now that I've been doing this, I've become what they consider a mid-sized podcast. So I'm obviously not Crime Junkies, and I'm not a small independent podcast anymore. Just what they call a mid-range one. And so I've had a lot of pressure on me to do the marketing and continue doing and treating it like a business and that. And I don't like that. I have a day job. I don't like that part of it. I like the research. I like all of it. I like the editing and all that. I do not like the marketing and trying to sell things and all that. So I was getting a little overwhelmed and feeling like, did I really want to keep doing this? And then I just realized I do want to keep doing it. I just want to keep doing it as a passion project and not be so focused on growth and all that stuff. Like, there's many of you that listen, and I'm thankful for every single one of you, and that is good enough for me. I don't need to be the next Ashley Flowers here. So anyways, I'm going to sort of keep going, and I'm not on any network deadlines, so I can just do what I want to do. And I just want to focus on cases that I find really interesting and bring them to you, whether you've heard them before or not. I just want to bring you cases that I enjoy researching and writing for whatever reason. So I will likely be back again next week with another terrible, awful case. And as always, you can do all the things that you want to do. I always appreciate comments and all that stuff. They do obviously help the algorithm. It is not essential to me. So thank you as always for just listening.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.